The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Naquana Lettman, and I work here at the Parkway Central upstairs in our Culinary Literacy Center. I am very honored to introduce tonight's guest. Deciding to follow his dreams, Kwame Onwuachi took a leap of faith and accomplished what some would say was nearly an impossible feat for a young Black chef. With his ancestors guiding him and his ambition driving him, his book depicts his life's journey to self-discovery through food. He writes, "I held onto those knives as a Marine does his rifle. Part of it was the thrill of holding them, and part was also because I was terrified they'd take them away. Crying over his school-issued knife set, he had no idea how he would pay for his education at the Culinary Institute of America. With his family's help, he turned his vision into a profitable catering company, a company that would not only pay for his education, but would provide him with the lessons needed to grow his passion and skill into a successful career as a chef and business owner. Tonight, he'll be joined in conversation with Chef Elijah Milligan. Chef Elijah is the co-founder of Cooking for the Culture. Cooking for the Culture is a collaborative dinner series that highlights talented Black chefs throughout Philadelphia. He is also the executive chef of Stove and Tap, a restaurant located in Lansdale, PA. Without further ado, please help me welcome Chefs Kwame Onwuachi and Elijah Milligan.
Hello, Chef.
Hello, hello.
How are you? Welcome to Philadelphia.
Thank you.
So we'll get started. I mean, first and foremost, congratulations on the book release. I'm sure it's a big weight off your shoulders. All the accolades at the restaurant. And you're what, just coming down from New York, right? For Food and Wine, Best New Chefs, was that what it was?
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. It's pretty good.
Thank you.
So I'm going to jump right in it. there's a lot, you know, I'm sure, like I said, you've been getting a lot of press lately. You know, a lot of people have been doing a lot of reading on you. I know the restaurant is doing great. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that go unnoticed is that you do have a Philly cheesesteak spot. Now, don't focus on the fact that you're talking to a bunch of people from Philly, and that's like our most notable sandwich. You want to tell us about that a little bit or what?
Yeah, I mean, it came from an idea. I was a little inebriated and coming home from a long shift at work in New York. And I always loved eating cheesesteaks growing up. I mean, I think there's a place in every single city to get like a cheesesteak, right? It's like an American,
absolutely.
It's an iconic sandwich in America. So I was eating that and I was like, man, it'd be cool if there was a place that served wings and like waffle fries at the same place. You know, it's like when I get older, I'm gonna create Philly wing fry. I always like said that. And
that
then I got a chance
awesome.
To do it.
And so you have two of them, right? You have one in Whole Foods and...
Yeah, so I have one in Whole Foods and one in like a marketplace, kind of like, the terminal market here.
Okay.
So we use like dry-aged beef. We confit our chicken wings and chicken fat. And then
nice.
We have waffle fries seasoned with bebede spice, which is like an Ethiopian spice
blend. That
sounds
delicious. Sounds great, right? All right, I think you passed. I think you get a Philly pass now. That's right.
You got to come down and try it out.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
I think another thing that's not talked about as much is that you were on Top Chef, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which season was that?
That was season 13 and 15.
13 and 15?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What was that experience like?
It was great. I learned a lot. I got to cook in front of a national audience, which was really fun. But I got to cook for some really amazing chefs. You know, that competition is real, you know, and it's a lot harder mm-hmm. than it looks.
Absolutely.
So it taught me a lot about myself, and it gave me a lot of confidence to kind of go out there and do my own thing.
No, for sure. Definitely. It's amazing. I have a lot of friends that went on that show. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get right into the book. I was actually fortunate to read it about a few weeks ago. I thought it was great. I thought, you know, as we spoke already, you know, I thought it was very brave of you to, you know, bring that out. And I think it's going to have a big impact on, you know, our culinary community. One of the most eye-popping things I saw, though, we'll kind of like circle back around, but you made 20 G's selling candy on the subway?
Yeah.
Wow, what kind of candy was it?
Snickers, Butterfingers, peanut M&Ms. Yeah, I took it very, very seriously.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I did that, for those of you who don't know, to start my own catering company. I sold candy on the subway in order to save capital for that. My mother was a caterer, and that's kind of, I'm following her footsteps.
Absolutely. So, you know, so I definitely saw that. What was that point that, you know, you looked in the mirror and said, I'm going to be a chef. I'm going to be a rock star chef when I grow up. What was that point, you think?
So the way that I started selling candy on the subway or starting a catering company was I walked into the store in Soho. I was just shopping. I walked in. It was a new shop. And I was talking to the person that worked the register. And she happened to be the owner of the store. She was like, I'm doing a store opening. You know, I need a caterer for my launch party. And I was like, let me just see what happens here. You know, I was like, I'm a caterer. And she was like, excuse me, how old are you? And I was like, ma'am, that is irrelevant.
Right.
You
know,
do you want your launch party to happen or not? I know you're in a time crunch. I'll do you this favor for you. And she was like, do you know how to make cheesecakes? And I was like, I said I was a chef. Like, please don't disrespect me.
Mm-hmm. And, right.
And cheesecake. So then she's like, all right, cool. Let's do a tasting tomorrow morning. I want these like mini strawberry cheesecakes. I was like, all right, cool. I'll see you later. I had never made a cheesecake in my life.
Right.
So I went home and, you know, make a cheesecake. It's a 3-hour process. You have to make the batter. You have to cook it. Then you have to let it cool before you can see the actual texture.
Right.
So that's like 3 hours.
Absolutely. Before you know if you mess it up or not.
Before you know if you mess it up or not. So, of course, the first 3 times I mess it up, now we're talking 9 hours later. You know, it's 5 a.m. in the morning. I finally perfect the cheesecake on like the 4th try. And I look around me, the kitchen's a mess, but like I'm in my element. Like I wasn't on my phone, I wasn't reading anything. I was literally just trying to make this cheesecake over and over and over until I perfected it. And I was a kid that had like ADHD, like you couldn't get me to sit down for anything. And for me to like really focus in on for me to focus on something, I knew in that moment that this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Absolutely. That's great.
Yeah.
What inspired you to write a memoir? And, you know, when I say that, you know, I think we both agree on this, you know, being a chef, especially a black chef, you know, cookbooks are very common. You see those all the time. But to talk about our actual experiences that we go through in the kitchen, and, you know, in that case where you are a black chef in a fine dining restaurant, now you're talking about a whole different level. Was there any moments where you thought like this might be a bad idea to write this book, or you know, you're scared to just want to let it out, right?
I'm like really, really believe in like walking in your purpose, like kind of like going where life is taking you. Also, you know, you got to strive for something, but taking opportunities and seeing where they end out. So I didn't even plan on writing a book. I was doing a talk. I used to do a lot of talks, like motivational speeches. And honestly, I would get invited to these things and I'd be like, I don't know why they invited me here, but I'm just going to tell you my life story. Hopefully that'll inspire you. If not, you know.
For sure.
It's cool. And I did that, and there was a literary agent in the crowd, and she said, you need to have a book. Like, this needs to go on pages.
Wow.
And I said, how much is this going to cost me? And she said, I don't get paid till you get paid. And I was like, all right, let's do this.
Cool.
So that's how it happened.
So, you know, in a book, you spoke a little bit of, like, you know, being a black male, being raised, like, kind of in the hood, being in that setting. And you heard some dirty laundry, you know, as far as growing up. That wasn't hard for you at all to, you know, kind of, you know, and I'm only saying this because I know being a black male, you kind of rise above, you know, what you were born into, and the first thing you want to do is put everything behind you, right? Mm-hmm. You want to hide everything. You want to, you know, don't look past it. That's obviously what makes you who you are. Was it hard to bring up those things? I mean, you spoke of, if you don't mind, you spoke of, like, you know, being abused by your father. You spoke of, you know, dealing drugs and all that stuff. Was that hard to, you know, bring those things back up and also put it out there for the world to see?
No, not really. It's something that I wanted. I think it's important to tell your life story. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it adds context. Not everyone's perfect. You know, not everyone had a
absolutely a
beautiful childhood. You know, and my childhood was still great. Unfortunate things happened, but that's part of life. And if I want to create a story, or I want to share a story that people can actually maybe get inspired from, maybe I create something that they can actually relate to. And that's why I wanted to just tell my story.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, you know, another big part about, you know, your book, and I know there was a lot of press that went out, like, immediately. You spoke about your experience at Per Se. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, or?
You know, it's in the book, so I'd leave it to that.
For sure,
yeah. I don't
want
to give it all away, but or even speak on it continuously. But, you know, I would say kitchens are a... It's a, it's like a zone that no one touches. It's like this is how things happen here. Like, people are tough on people. If you can't like get with it, then you get out essentially. And it gives people a platform to do whatever they want, whether it's, you know, working people to death, abusing people, and, you know, physically or verbally. Mm-hmm. And for me, I know it brought back a lot of psychological issues, you know, that I faced as a child.
Absolutely.
And it brought that back up, and I still had to put my head down and keep pushing, which I did, you know, no problem. But I think the cycle needs to stop in some ways, you know, because there's behavior that wouldn't really fly in any other profession that happens in the kitchen, and we want to look at ourselves as a professional craft, but we don't want to act like professionals. And it's important that we start doing that to hopefully break the cycle.
Agreed. Do you credit that experience to who you are today as a chef?
Absolutely, yeah.
Right. What parts do you think? Do you think, like, the discipline aspect of it, how you treat your employees now?
I think it all, you know, it's all a process. So, like, you know, the hard times that I went through, it shows me what not to do. You know, the good things that I went through show me what to do. And those times when I am regurgitating things that I have been, that I went through, you know, I think back to those moments and how I felt. And try to curb those outbursts or,
awesome.
When, you know.
No, for sure, yeah. Definitely. Like I said, I agree. We talked a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked myself. I worked in a pretty fine dining establishment in Philadelphia, Lubeck Finn. And, I mean, it was rough. Definitely rough. So I definitely shared our experience. So your restaurant, Kith and Kin, I mean, you've been blown up a lot of publicity, a lot of great things I've been hearing about it. I feel bad for not even getting down there yet to
it's
eat.
It's all good.
Soon, though. Soon, right?
You get a cheesesteak, too, while you're down there.
Get a cheesesteak, too?
Yeah.
But that wasn't your first restaurant.
Mm-mm.
First restaurant was Shaw Bijou, right?
Mm-hmm.
That opened up, what year was that, Shaw?
Shaw Bijou opened 2016,
right? And how long did that last?
3 months.
3 months.
Yeah. $2 million investment.
Mm-hmm.
2 years of hard work. And it closed in 3 months.
Yeah. That's the business. It sounds like a business.
Mm-hmm.
What was the concept for that restaurant?
It was a fine dining concept. So it was a story of my life through food. And it was like modern American cuisine with global influence.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit of everything. So what we did was we took an Italianate row house. It's a 200-year-old row house, so we turned it into a restaurant. So,
how many seats do you have in there?
We had 32 seats.
32?
Yeah, it was small. It was 9 tables.
Nice.
Yeah,
those are always
really
fun,
nice.
Though.
Yeah, but it was an experience, you know. Like, you walk in, you walk upstairs to the bar, the bartender's mm-hmm. there. First thing they do is sit you down, ask you, what would you like to drink? You could have any drink you'd like. We make you a cocktail, a bite comes out.
Nice.
Then we built a staircase that went right into the kitchen. You walk down the staircase, you got a course in the kitchen, and then you walked into the dining room and started your meal.
That sounds amazing, for one. 32 seats. That sounds pretty cool. It was open for 3 months.
3 months, yeah.
3 months. Mm-hmm. How'd you feel when that closed?
It was like, yeah, exactly. It was like losing a loved one. It was
And it was all tastings, right? What was it?
It was tasting menu. We had a bar menu upstairs as well where you can get little bites.
Okay.
That's where the cheesesteak
right
was on it.
The cheesesteak was on it. Keep bringing up the cheesesteak.
We did it with like 100-day dry aged Wagyu beef.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Also.
Mm-hmm.
No, that experience definitely teaches us, you know, and it humbles you. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And I think one of the things, I mean, and we all know it's not fair, but I think you had a major critic come in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Day one?
First day, first customer.
First day.
Yeah, biggest food critic on arguably the East Coast.
How's that for you?
Pete Wells. It was not favorable. It was a it was what he calls a first bite. But it wasn't horrible. It wasn't what we should be getting at our level, though.
Yeah.
You know, for what we're charging. And yeah, it wasn't good.
In comparison, our Philadelphia food writer waits about 3 months for a restaurant to open before he even goes in and touches it. You know, you got about a good 4 months before a review actually comes out, which really helps with business. So I'm sure that I love the idea. Would you do it again?
Absolutely. The first chance I get, I'll do it again.
I love that. So what's the food that we could find if we were to go down to Kith and Kin right now?
So Kith and Kin is Afro-Caribbean cuisine. It's based off of my heritage. So my father is Nigerian and Jamaican, mm-hmm. and my mother is Creole and Trinidadian.
Nice.
So those are the four pillars, and then we play around within the diaspora, within the Caribbean, within the American South, like around those pillars. So
cool. So you lived in Nigeria first and moved to New York?
I lived in New York City for most of my life, and then when I was 10 years old, I lived in Nigeria.
How long did you spend in Nigeria?
2 years.
2 years, nice. Mm-hmm. What was that experience like?
I mean, I went from playing PlayStation to doing my homework by candlelight, so it was a...
Right.
It was a shift. It was a huge shift.
Not the easiest.
Yeah, we had to raise our own animals, fetch our own water, you know. So
now, are there any menu items that we could find at Kith and Kin that like really relate to that Nigerian experience?
Yeah, so there's a couple. So there's jollof rice, mm-hmm. which is like the staple of Nigeria. There's egusi stew that's on the menu sometimes. We have suya, like our version. All of these are my versions, so they're
kind
of like the cheesesteak, you know. But when Nigerians come, they do love it. And when people from Philadelphia come to the cheesesteak shop,
they love it.
Because they all are like, what is this? And then they get it.
He's winning like, us over a little bit, huh?
And they're like, all right. So,
I think we'll give the cheesesteak a shot. I got to take you off for cheesesteaks before you leave town or something.
All right, sounds good.
Any questions for the crowd?
Hi, I only got as far as the dinner at the Afro-American
Museum. Oh, the first chapter.
Yeah, this morning. But I've read in articles about your book that you cooked for the Obamas, too, at the mm-hmm. White House. And I wondered, I don't know if that's in the book and be giving anything away, but I wonder if you'd comment on that experience.
Yeah, so I cook for them in the vein of, there's the White House Easter egg roll every year. So, how did it happen? It's an interesting story. I went to a Wizards game. So you'll see in the book, I did a lot of pop-ups at a certain point in my career. I stopped in Philly too, which is pretty cool.
Oh, really? Nice.
Yeah, a while ago. And when I stopped in DC, there was a restaurateur that she really enjoyed my food, and we stayed friends till this day. And she was like one of my biggest supporters. When I moved back to DC, she was the first person to come to the Shaw Bijou, first person to come to Kith and Kin.
Nice.
But she just took me out to a Wizards game, and then the person sitting next to us was the speechwriter for Joe Biden and Obama. So he was like, come to the White House, I'll show you around and give you like a private tour. So I went there and I did the private tour, and then I went to, I think it was the West Wing, that's where like the mm-hmm. First Lady's offices are. So that was where Michelle Obama's offices were. And there was a couple like interns there that saw me on Top Chef that were like making like a big deal about it that
nice.
I was there. And then the coordinator was there for the Easter egg roll. So she was like, oh, this is perfect timing. Do you want to cook? And then I went and cooked for the Easter egg roll. Okay. So that's how that happened.
I love Top Chef, and it was great to see you on there as well. Tell me about how did you prepare for Top Chef? How did you, before you went on, how did you prepare?
I tried to watch the show as much as I could, but I just got so much anxiety because I was like, well, I don't know what I would do if I had to cook out of a vending machine. What the hell am I going to do? So like I had to stop watching it. But then I just went through the basics of things that I already learned, like, you know, proper emulsions, you know, egg cookery.
The basic stuff, right? That's what you think about the most.
Yeah, I just honestly, I just did all the basic stuff, you know, so I could just have that and build off of that, because that's the most important thing with cooking anyway, is knowing the basics. So I wrote out, you know, 40 of the most basic techniques that I know, or like things that are asked of you, and I just did those recipes, you know, one a day, and that was it. That's how I prepared for it.
Cool. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So my question is, after Bijou,
mm-hmm.
Okay, after Bijou closed, I know you said that you took a few months to get yourself together. Like, what was the process in getting back on the horse, so to speak? Like,
yeah.
Cooking and what is the next thing? So what was the process for that?
For me, it was a lot of self-reflection. So the day after the restaurant closed, I wanted, while it was still fresh on my mind, to write down everything that went wrong and everything that went right. So I could, you know, whenever I did get myself together, I could have something that was like very close to, you know, without a jaded opinion or anything. It was just like, let's just write this. And I got my team together, like my core team. And it was like, let's just write it all down. What would we do differently? You know, if we got $1 million to do this again tomorrow, how would we do this a little bit differently? And we wrote all of that down. So that helped me a lot when I finally got myself back up. But I was depressed for a while, you know, but I had people around me that believed in me more than I believed in myself. And that's, I think, really, really important to have around you at all times. So they're with you with the good and the bad. So when the bad happens, it's like, dust yourself off, get back up.
You had mentioned that there were a few things at your restaurant in D.C. I didn't pick them up, that your favorite items. Can you repeat them? And then maybe speak to one of them, about one of them, what it means to you, mm-hmm. and what's your take on it and where it came from, like a little story behind that.
So the ones that I mentioned earlier weren't my favorite. Those are ones from Nigeria. More importantly, those are just like dishes that reflected of, you know, where I grew up. But my favorite dish on the menu is probably the curried goat roti. It's a Trinidadian influenced dish. And it's really important to me because it's one of my earliest food memories. I would say egusi stew, which is a Nigerian dish, and then dalpoi roti with curry goat. My grandfather is Trinidadian on my mother's side, and I just remember my grandmother like grabbing this bread. I had to have been like 2 years old, and I remember like my mom holding me, and she went to the fridge, took the roti out, put it in the microwave for like, you know, 50 seconds, pulled it out. It was like so pillowy. I was like, oh, what's that? That's weird. She ripped it off. She dipped it in the curry and then put it in my mouth, and it was like an explosion, like the textures, the dal, you know, crumbling in between the layers, and all the spicy curry and the flavors that are in that curry, you know, and the subtleness from like the green seasoning, all that stuff was very impactful to me. So for me, what I do is I get a whole goat, we break it down, we marinate it in green seasoning. So for those of you who don't know, green seasoning is a Trinidadian marinade. Its main components are like celery, culantro, green onions, white onions, ginger, garlic, scotch bonnet pepper, curry powder. So we make that in-house fresh, and we marinate the goat in that, and then we braise it, we sear it off, then we braise it in chicken stock for like 6 hours so it's really tender. And then we remove the goat meat and then reduce that liquid and then add it back to the meat. And then separately, we make a curry veloute. So the veloute is like a velvety sauce. It's usually thickened with a blanc roux. A roux is an emulsion of like flour and fat that you cook out in different shades of color to thicken something or add flavor. The longer you cook it, the more flavor. You know, the less you cook it, the less flavor, but the thicker it makes whatever
still
you're making.
Still a thickening agent.
So, I make a curry veloute, and then I have the goat, and when I pick it up, meaning when I cook it on the line, I'll add the goat, then add the curry veloute, and then reduce that all down, and then add some fermented scotch bonnet peppers, lime juice. And then the dalpoi roti we cook to order. So when we serve it, we serve that bowl of roti. We'll fry some potatoes, some marble potatoes. We'll glaze them in a green seasoning aioli to further accentuate those flavors, and then top that. And then top it all with like micro celery and celery curls. So that's my favorite dish. It's got a lot, we put a lot of work into it. And we still keep the roots of the dish intact. You know, I'm just adding a couple things that I the way that I view food through like my culinary lens now based on my experiences, so.
What are your top three favorite restaurants besides your own?
Hmm. In the world?
Yeah, in the world.
Okay, there's a restaurant in New York City called Fish Cheeks. That's a Thai restaurant.
That's really good.
Really, really tasty. There is a restaurant in San Francisco called Benu that I really enjoy. Corey. Mm-hmm. Corey Lee.
Yeah, he's great.
It's like a Chinese-Korean fine dining restaurant. And then my restaurant, Kith & Kin. Oh, you said besides
well, that's
your
that's not
own,
fair, right? One more. Come
okay.
on, chef.
All right. Lastly would probably be Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair in New York City.
What are some choices that you made for decisions in running your kitchen now in reflecting the culture that you want to see? And what does your kitchen feel like? And how do you make decisions about your team and all of that?
1 second. Hi, Shayna. How are you?
So that's a great question. It's a loaded answer. The kitchen is run, my style is very collective. So let's say we're launching a new menu, for example, everyone gets a say in like what should be on the new menu. Like for example, like a server got a dish on the menu the last time around, just by giving ideas. It's like an open platform. No idea is stupid. You know, I'll let you test out whatever you want. We can order whatever you want as long as you like get to service on time and like prep your station out. If you have a little bit of extra time, then you can yeah. create whatever you want. And also I have one-on-ones with my staff a lot. So like I'll sit down with them, see how they're doing. You know, I write down their goals to make sure that I'm doing everything that I can to help them because they're doing everything that they can to help me. You know, but yes, I'm paying them, but also I wouldn't be like even standing on the stage without my team. So it's important to have that one-on-one connection. And then if there is something wrong, like they're showing up late often or they are not performing as well as they used to, I usually just sit them down and say like, what's going on? Why are you late? Do we need to like move your schedule? Because maybe sometimes people have children they have to take to school and they're like rushing to get that done. And then they come in late because they're stuck in traffic and I don't know these intricacies. So I get to sit down with them and ask them these questions and they have the open floor. And so that's a little inside to how my kitchen is, but there are a lot of things in day-to-day that I don't even, you know, I can't even remember right now.
Right. I think a lot of people don't realize that when you become a chef of a restaurant, you're actually more of a therapist than an excellent cook, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to learn how to talk to people. Mm-hmm. And not just people like broadly, but like individually, like how can I push this person? You know, what can I get away with when talking to this person? You know, it's really, really important to know your staff. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how you went from telling your story on a stage to actually making a book from it? What mm-hmm. was
what
the
was
process,
process
like and what did you learn?
So the way that works is you write a proposal. So after I met with the literary agent, we sat down, I described the book to her, then I had to sell it to the agency essentially. Like, would the agency want to bring me on? So I went and told my story in person, like my final hoorah story. And then I told the bad parts as well as the good parts because like, yeah, everyone wants a success story, but they also want a real story, you know? And that's where I think being honest and open about your life is like really important. So after that, then you write a proposal and that can be anywhere from 30 to 60 pages. So sometimes you would consult and pay like a co-writer to help you write the proposal. I wrote the proposal myself. And then from there, you then shop it around to all of the publishing houses, you know, like Penguin, Random House, and Doubleday, and all this stuff. So you do that. And then after you choose the publisher you want to work with, then you sit down. I sat down with a co-author and we talked for hours on the phone. Like, first we talked on the phone, then we met in person, then I would write stuff and send it to him and he'd write it back to me and we would like write my life in chronological order and like the most exciting parts of my life, leave out the years that was boring and then go from there. And then you write one chapter at a time. After you have like this timeline and you break it down to chapters, then you write one chapter at a time, then it's like, do we throw away chapters? This actually didn't happen like this, you know? It's like a really lengthy process. It took 2.5 years, so.
I just wanted to know the name of the restaurant. What does that mean and its significance?
Kith and Kin?
Yes.
So I was, it was when, after the Strawberry Zoo closed, I was do events, and I did an event for Questlove, and he does these food salons in his house. But he did one in D.C. for Earth Day, and he gave me the Impossible meat. It's like the Impossible burger meat. And I tasted it. To me, it didn't really taste like meat, so I was like, what am I going to do with this? Like, I got to figure out what to do with this. So I was like, let me season it like a Jamaican beef patty. I could put a lot of flavor into it. So I, you know, made the dough, stuffed it, made like this calypso sauce, and then it was like my fiance, my best friend, we were like eating it all around the kitchen island. And they were like, why don't you cook like this all the time? Like every time you cook like food, like from where you're from, it's always like really delicious, and you do it like without a recipe, on the fly. And in that moment, I was like, this is something. So like I just ran to the computer and Googled friends and family, and Kith and Kin popped up. So Kith is friends in Middle English, and Kin is family in Old English. And I thought the name was really cool, so I just kept it.
It's a great name. It's a great name for us. I love it.
Thank you.
All right, and then last question for you.
Hi. So I'm all about right now at this stage in my life, like just learning from other people and their experiences and things. Mm-hmm. So lately we've been having a roundtable just with our 40 and 50 year old friends. What would you tell your 20 year old self? But since you're in that stage, I'm asking you 40 years from now, what do you want to be most remembered for? 40 years from now.
Inspiring people. You know, I would like to be remembered for that in any capacity. It doesn't matter if it's just cooking, just continuing to go and thinking positively and knowing your true worth, you know. That's what I want to be remembered for.
Awesome. Thank you, Chef.
Yeah.
We have a round of applause for Chef.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.